Okay, thank you for coming. I think we're going to go ahead and get started. I'm supposed to make the obligatory announcement that AIA credits are available, and I think you can sign up outside the door. Mr. Swift, thank you for joining us. My name is Kevin Klinkenberg. I'm a principal at 180 Degrees Design Studio in Kansas City. Like many of my colleagues, we're a new urbanist practicing firm, and I'm delighted to moderate this session today. We've got a really outstanding panel who has tremendous knowledge on this topic, and so I'm going to get to them as quickly as possible here. I'll do some very brief introductions at the top, and then I think we'll just go right into the presentations. Yeah, Henry Cisneros is not here, but we are in fact blessed with Stephanos Palazoides instead. So this is a really critical topic for those of you who are especially new to the form-based code area. The idea of seeing the world through the lens of building types versus FAR or other use-based approaches is a sea change in really the approach to regulating communities. And so we have three practitioners who are really excellent and have a tremendous knowledge on this topic. In fact, all of us are architects, which is also unusual. I think when we probably were in architecture school, we didn't imagine we'd be writing zoning codes for much of our career, but nonetheless, that's the nature of the profession and the need, especially at this point in time. Our first speaker is going to be Dan Perolik.
Can you have one mango person to transfer my presentation?
Okay, our first speaker is not going to be Dan Perolik. It's going to be Marina Corey instead. That's right. Marina is the Director of Town Planning with Duane Platter Zeibrick and Company, and she has been the project director on Miami 21, which is the largest application of a form-based code to date for the city of Miami, and an architect as well. And I think as soon as we get the technology hooked right back up here, we'll start with Marina. Marina will be followed by Dan, hopefully. Dan is principal with Opticos Design in Berkeley, California, and a board member of the Form-Based Code Institute, and recently published a book with his wife that's actually entitled Form-Based Codes and is available for sale in the bookstore downstairs. It's sort of a complete compendium on the topic and what's going on in the practice nationally, and it's well worth your read. And then Stephanos Palazoides will be our final speaker with Mullen Palazoides in Pasadena, California, one of the founding members of CNU and needs very little introduction. So I think what we'll do is start with Marina, who's going to talk a little bit about the smart code and the application of Miami 21 in particular.
Thank you. Okay, hi, thanks for coming. And I'm going to focus primarily the presentation today on Miami 21 and how we coded the high-density part of town, because I'm sure a lot of you have seen presentations on the lower transect zones, the T3, the T4, and the T6s for us in Miami were quite challenging. So the majority of my presentation will be focused on that. But just taking a step back in our practice, in our office, Seaside was the first form-based code, as far as I know, done back in 1981, well, in this century, or past century, after the Second World War. Use of historic precedents, and basically typologically based, building type based. From there it evolved to the transect, which was probably first introduced back in 1997. I'm sure most of you know the transect. I don't have to explain it, but it changed the direction of how we started coding our projects, and we moved from a sort of a building types approach to more of the transect-based approach, and incorporated that into the introduction of the smart code, which I think we first introduced, I was trying to remember this, back sometime in 2003. The first application of it was for a project, at least in our practice at DPZ, in a town called Newtown St. Charles, which is outside of Missouri, in which we used a smart code as an overlay to get the zoning done for the project. And it was the first time we had sort of taken different building types and introduced them into the different transect zones. And the way it was done is that we took these different building types and very, very clearly allocated or described the types in terms of the building setbacks, in terms of building coverage, in terms of heights, in terms of frontage requirements, each one having specific requirements. And that became the basis for Miami 21, which is what I'll spend some time speaking about today. So while I'm here presenting it, I'm here representing a tremendous group of practitioners who have been involved in this. DPZ is sort of the lead consultant on this, but in fact, my co-project manager is here in the audience, Francisco. It's been 2.5 years in the making, and there's been a transportation component to this. There's an economic development component to this with ERA. There's a parks and open space component to this, and it's all informed how we started coding this project. So what is it? It's a complete overhaul of the existing city's zoning code. It's not an optional code. It's not a floating code. It's a mandatory code. It uses the form-based code the smart code as a guideline or as a template for how the project's being or how the code is being implemented, and with a focus obviously on form more so than use and density. And it applies the smart growth principles too. And what's interesting about this one for Miami is that it really it ranges the gamut from the single family home all the way to the downtown 80 stories and above transect zones and everything in between. So why do we need to do it, and why are we proposing a form-based code for the city? Well, obviously Miami is based on Euclidean zoning. It's not unlike many other cities around the country that have zoning regulations that that are based on use, that are based on density, that create an unpredictable form. There was also the need to provide very clear guidelines on how we were going to address the public realm. And Miami has very specific cases of single-family homes right next to commercial corridors that had an unlimited height zoning back in the early 80s, late 70s. In order to encourage economic development in the city, the planning department basically put in a very, very high density and FAR allocation to a lot of the parts of the downtown. And there were these commercial corridors being developed right next to single-family homes that were creating some real disparities in transitions. And so that was one of the reasons why Miami 21 even came about. How do we address these transition zones? We also wanted to create a more efficient permitting process. And the idea, how we sold this to the city was, by creating a more predictable form, you're going to get a more sort of streamlined and efficient permitting process, we hope. And there was also the idea to encourage economic development, to encourage green building, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you begin? In a city like Miami, we divided it into four different quadrants with the idea that we would adopt it in one quadrant and test it out with the architects, with the attorneys, with the developers in the different quadrants before it got adopted citywide. And it was a very careful breaking down of where these quadrants, how these quadrants got divided. We look at the commissioners' districts, we look at all the different neighborhood associations, and we natural boundaries. And we began with the east quadrant because it did happen to be the one that had the downtown. It was the one that was most susceptible to development pressures. It was the one that was going to have the greatest range of transect zones. And we've been in the east quadrant now for 2.5 years. We had initially thought we would do 6 months per quadrant, not really thinking through that we'd have to write the entire code for the city. And then go on to the mapping. So now the idea is to get the code implemented citywide, adopted in principle citywide, but not implemented until all the quadrants have been mapped. So two goals to Miami 21, seemingly contradictory, but not necessarily so. Conservation, the preservation of the neighborhoods, the conservation of the historic districts, the ability to create sustainable development system green initiatives that the mayor's spearheaded, the increased access to the natural environment, and to create safe, vibrant, pedestrian-friendly frontages and neighborhoods. And on the other side of the spectrum with the development, the development community was very, very anxious and very concerned about what this was going to do to their projects. Miami, like many cities, experienced unprecedented growth in the past 10 years, and they wanted to ensure that they weren't going to be affected in any negative manner. So we told them we're going to, you know, hopefully provide you with a simpler system of how to do this. I won't run through this. You can read it yourselves. I want to jump into the code. So part of the educational process was introducing the public to the whole concept of the transect and how it worked, and illustrating the examples for Florida. Now, Miami in particular, contrary to Miami Beach, had a lot of T6, had a lot of T3, but very little sort of T4 and T5. And their T5 was very, very badly handled. They jumped from 18 units an acre all the way to 65 with nothing in between. So we were trying to give them densities to sort of plug in. I can't stress the importance of the analysis of the existing code before we could even begin to provide a smart code or a form-based code. We had to really, really gain an understanding of what the city had and understand what that meant in terms of the development rights and the development capacity of all these lots and all these different sizes. We had to understand what it meant for single-family homes and how to fight the McMansion syndrome. And then we had to, from the homeowners associations and neighbors who were so concerned about that, and from the developer standpoint, we had to make sure we weren't taking away development rights. We also knew we were going to have to work with transitions of density, as I talked about before. There were a lot of lots, and I'm sure this isn't particular to Miami, that had zoning that just wasn't consistent with the depth of lots or the widths of lots. And so you were getting aggregation of lots that weren't making sense and zoning changes that weren't making any sense. There was no rationale behind how one part was zoned or a zoning change was requested, and that was what was creating all this trouble. The city's zoning is an absolute, not only do they have, 12, 13 zoning categories, but they have a bunch of special districts that they added on top of that. Each one, with a little amendment that might make a change to the district, but it became impossible to try to really understand them. But we did that, and we went through an exhaustive analysis of these zoning categories, one per page, really trying to understand what the constraints and what the opportunities for each category was so that we would know how to code it appropriately. We also spent a lot of time educating the public on what the unpredictability of the existing zoning entailed. And Miami, not unlike other cities too, has calculates their density based on, or their FAR based on, gross lot area. And depending on where you are in the city, whether you're on a corner or whether you're facing the water or whether you're in a mid-block, your capacity varied tremendously, as this diagram shows. And in addition, the city also provided for benefits, bonuses, affordable housing, PUDs. And the PUD was an absolute joke. I mean, they didn't have to do anything, but they were able to get that bonus, and every developer availed themselves of that. So we did a lot of this kind of mapping to really try and understand what the ultimate capacity was so that we would know how to translate. We also spent a lot of time educating the public, not only on smart growth principles, but how the building form could change when it was next to single-family homes. So this is a series of diagrams actually prepared by the City of Miami that walks through a step-by-step process of what the problems were when you have high-rise development right next to single family, but how you can keep that capacity but address it in a more pedestrian-friendly manner. So this is about moving the tower to the front. It's about lining the parking garages because, they don't go underground, or they haven't yet. We're confident they will once they see this new code. It's not uncommon to see 14, 16-story parking structures that weren't lined or aren't lined. So it became imperative to ask them to start lining their towers. We also spent some time talking about successional growth and how cities grow naturally. And we illustrated these ideas based on the way the grids and the way the blocks were laid out for the city. This example ties back to the one I just saw on the previous page about how you successionally grow a neighborhood, if it's warranted, by moving the tower forward, by lining the garage, by maybe rezoning a part of the city from T3 to T4 if that neighborhood is ready to grow. There are also other cases when the commercial corridors run in the opposite direction, perpendicular to the street, in which you might have a historic neighborhood abutting it, and so that entailed a very different approach. So we did a series of these sort of illustrations. We also spoke conceptually about how cities grow over time and whether they grow linearly or whether they should grow nodally. And we were trying to encourage Miami to think in terms of growing nodally and where their transit-oriented nodes were and how to densify those areas. So we had diagrams that showed where that should be and where it was logical to densify. So an analysis of these existing categories, and we were able to clearly fold in many of these categories into single transect zones. And the yellow ones you see on the bottom page are the translations. This I should spend maybe a little bit of time talking about, because this is probably what's different from other places. It's certainly different than from what we've ever done. But we spent a lot of time with these development capacities. So how do you maintain the capacity of a town, but especially of the high-rise environments, but create a predictable form? And at first, when we began to code this, we thought we're going to do away with FAR and we're just strictly going to mandate heights. And we very quickly realized it was impossible to do. If we would just give height limits in the 30, 40, 60-story areas, but not give FAR limits, we were going to overdevelop some parts of town because everybody would just, given the price of land, max out their tower size, go up, and that would be it. And we'd get a consistent tower form with everybody trying to reach as high as they could for as much as they could. So we began to realize we needed to do a conversion from of an FAR. And going to Vancouver, and we had just done a project in Vancouver. We loved what Larry Beasley had done in Vancouver, and we used a lot of their methodologies of translating FAR. So we came up with something called FLR, floor lot ratio, and we had a very hard time convincing the architects and the developers that we were going to change the way they were going to code, they were going to be able to calculate their capacity. So we studied lots ranging from 5,000 to 100,000 and over square feet. We studied the mid-block condition, corner lot, and corner lot on open space, and went through a conversion. The first conversion was telling developers, you're no longer going to get gross lot area, you're going to calculate your capacity on net lot area. So it doesn't matter if you have a 10,000 square foot lot, wherever it's located, your capacity will be the same. The second was the City of Miami, to complicate matters, calculates their capacity on net floor area, meaning they exclude parking, they exclude their mechanical rooms, they exclude a lot of different, a lot of square footage that when you imagine the parking requirements in a city like Miami and they don't have to line the parking, it can double the capacity. So we went through a conversion of, well, how much, well, what is the parking requirements, well, how do we calculate what the mechanical and commercial area and common area should be, applied a conversion factor to that, and came up with a base FLR, which was replacing the FAR. And then in addition to that, we started to calculate what the public benefits should be in addition to that base FLR, and I'll talk about that in a second. So we came up with six. It was five. For those of you who have been following the Miami 21 online, it's now six zoning categories. And they're listed up here. The T6812, for example, means you are allowed 8 stories as of right, and you can bonus up to 12. You're allowed 12 stories as of right, you can bonus up to 20. They each have an FLR assigned to them, and they each have an additional benefit FLR assigned to them. So, for example, if you have a 100,000 square foot lot and you have a 5 FLR, you can build 500,000 square feet, and that has to accommodate absolutely everything. We also went through a series of diagrams. I mean, everybody was so upset about this at first. The developers, what, you're taking away our parking? They didn't understand that we weren't, but we had just built that into our calculations. So we went through a whole series of exercises to prove to them this is what you can do in the current code, this is what you can do in the new code. The public benefits was a huge component of it, and this is one thing that we are pushing the city very, very hard to try and maintain. There's a great need for additional parks, additional open space, preservation of historic buildings, affordable housing. How do you incentivize green buildings? And so we created a public benefits program that would give developers additional density bonuses depending on how they avail themselves of these or how they use this capacity. So, for example, if a developer were to provide a park in an area identified in the Goody Clancy master plan, they would get twice the capacity. Or if they provided affordable housing on-site, twice the development capacity. If they provided it off-site, once the development capacity, and then they could always pay into a trust fund. The mayor's been very supportive of trying to get LEED certified buildings in the city, and the code basically mandates that any new construction over 50,000 square feet will have to be LEED Silver certified. But if a developer goes above and beyond that, they can get additional development capacity also. So here we are, the summary of the transect zones. T3, T4, T5 are pretty standard. I'm sure you all know that. The T6s, I'll go into them a little more depth a little later on, but you can see all the zoning categories that they replaced. And we also had two industrial districts. Now we're going to have more special districts, as we call them. The east quadrant happened to have industrial areas, and there was a lot of debate about how do you retain industrial uses that don't become nonconforming while also encouraging residential development. And so we came up with this workplace zone, which would encourage more work but also allow for some residential, but in a very, very limited capacity. So the T3, there's an illustration of the problems with T3, which I won't go into because it's very particular to Miami, what the T3 should be, and then the three different T3 categories. Now, we have something called R, L, and O. It's a little different to the way it's structured in the smart code, but restricted, limited, and open, which basically talks about the intensity of the use that's allowed. R always means strictly, basically residential with very few other uses allowed. In the case of the T3, there was single family. There was single family with an accessory unit or granny flat in the back, and then duplex housing. We worked with architects in Miami to really illustrate for the public what that change would mean, because people were very afraid that their homes would become nonconforming or because a lot of them had the condition that you see in the front with the two-car garage in the front, and we were trying to preclude that based on our code. We're limiting the frontage requirement for a garage to about 30% to prevent, you know, the majority of the site being accommodated by a two-car garage to the front. So we went through a series of exercises in the single-family home, showing, you know, ad nauseum drawings like this to reassure the public that they could do what they could do before, with certain exceptions such as parking, and to preclude the McMansions. Same thing, this is showing how the accessory units can be coded. T4 was basically reintroducing the concept of a townhouse or a small apartment house or, you know, four-pack or six-pack, as well as a small office building. T5, same thing. And the difference in our T5 and our T6 is that we've waived the parking requirements in the sense that you don't have to provide the parking on site to really encourage the redevelopment of small sites in Miami. We've told them if you provide the parking off site, in addition, we've got a bunch of different reductions allowed for parking waivers if you're near transit or et cetera. We're hoping that because the T5 zoning or the equivalent of the T5 zoning in the city of Miami is basically you dingbat building, you park under and you live above, and we're obviously trying to avoid that. And here are the T6s. We spent a lot of time trying to understand how do you transition from a single family to a T6 category. And this diagram illustrates two different ways to do it. The first one is if you have a single family home, like a historic neighborhood where it's not going to, where you can't imagine successionally zoning that area, how do you transition to a T6 where you have additional setback requirements? Or you could imagine the successional zoning, like the drawing on the right. We had to do an insane amount of parking capacity studies to really make sure we weren't taking away capacity, because with all these additional setbacks, we needed to make sure that, given the typical lot sizes in the city, developers could provide for their parking on site if they chose to do so. So we studied parking capacities on, you know, 100-foot depths, 80-foot depths, 150-foot depths, to really make sure that we were coding this appropriately. And we work with ARX, who have a booth actually downstairs, on doing these wonderful sort of fly-throughs and showing the city how they, residents, how these transitions could occur. And we've basically dealt with the T6s by establishing an 8-story maximum height for the pedestal, where we're hoping the parking will fit, and then there are tower limits, and the towers can go above and beyond that. And we have floor plate limits for the towers of 18,000 for the residential and about 30 for the commercial. So that's very, very generous. We went through a series of diagrams that showed how these neighborhoods could transition. And these are what the T6 sheets look like in the code. As you can see, there's information on the pedestal. There's information on towers. There are tower separations that are required now, 60 feet minimum separations. And then there are the different illustrations of the examples of whether you're abutting T3, T4, T5, and what those setback requirements need to be. And we did this for all the different zoning categories. And obviously, you don't have a T6 48 next to a T3. That just doesn't happen. So the quality of the public realm, specifically in T6, was about providing for wider sidewalks. Miami happens to be a city that has very narrow sidewalks, so we require that all the open space requirements in the T6s be provided in the form of wide sidewalks. So the developers have to provide for an additional 10-foot setback. In addition to that, on the private property, we require liners, 100% on the primary frontages, 50% on the secondary frontages. There's the transitions of heights and intensity I just spoke about, as well as predictable floor plate and height limits. We spend a lot of time working with the AIA in Miami and a bunch of different architects trying to help them resolve their issues. And I just listed this here for I just thought it was interesting. These are the sort of flash issues that were of key concern to them. Obviously, this translation of FAR to FLR was a key concern, and we spent a lot of time trying to educate them on that. Succeeded with some, did not with others. The idea of the setback for the wider sidewalks, they all accepted that once they understood that we were replacing their open space requirements. The idea of limiting the size of the floor plates was a little harsh. You know, I always go back to Vancouver as an example that has a limit of 6,500 square feet. This is a case in which we really gave in to the developers, who kept screaming that they wanted much bigger floor plates. But not only do we have floor plate sizes, but we have maximum length that towers can be to avoid these very, very long, interminable buildings sizes. We have frontage requirements, too. We were told that's limiting our creativity, but we showed them how that wasn't the case. We have the parking requirements that are being waived in many cases, as well as the liners. We're requiring pedestrian passages if you're developing an entire block that's more than X distance, I think it's 450 feet from an intersection. There are the maximum minimum heights we had to convince them of in terms of floor plate sizes, too, getting people to stop thinking in terms of maximum feet and thinking in terms of maximum number of stories. And then there's the whole green building requirements we spent a lot of time talking to the AIA about. Lastly, the architects were, again, you know, screaming that we were taking away their creativity by imposing a form on them. We tried to convince them that we really weren't. We have setbacks the way the current code has setbacks. We have this 8-foot pedestal to try and encourage them to, and that's based on the typical right-of-ways in the city of Miami in order to try to get light into the streets. So there's an additional 10-foot setback. But above and beyond that, they can do whatever they want with their towers as long as they limit the floor plate sizes and the distance between the different towers. So the commission didn't quite believe us, so they hired some architects, about 4 or 5 different architects from Miami and Boston, actually this is Elkis Manfredi, to test out the code and to do a series of diagrams and extrusions or axonometrics of what the current code allows and what the new code can allow. And we worked so hard trying to convince them, if you can do it in the 11,000, which is the existing code, just show exactly the same thing in Miami 21, if it indeed can happen. And they couldn't quite get there. But what this shows is that you can basically do the same thing. You can sculpt the building in a different way. We're not taking away the creativity. So there was a series of these diagrams that were presented to the different commissioners. And so in summary, what we're hoping Miami 21 is going to do, well, it's creating this predictability of height and intensity. We've told them it's going to be a much, much clearer code. It went from being about over 2,000 pages to, I think, slightly under 300. We believe, obviously, it's providing for significant improvements to the public realm. There will no longer be these exposed garage spaces, which we all think is a good thing. And while developers are screaming about the fact that the habitable liners won't be used, we're seeing that those who are providing them in the building, because the planning department's been mandating it for a while now, they are providing for affordable workplace and affordable housing in the downtown. There's obviously a requirement for active use on the ground floor. The public benefits program, we're very, very excited about that. There's also the incentive for the creation of civic spaces, the green buildings, the allowing of the granny flats, which is a big thing, actually, because many neighborhoods in Miami preclude that and have these granny flats, but they're illegal right now. And so the fact that we legalize them, we think, is a great thing. And then, obviously, the historic preservation and the streamlining of the permitting process. And I think that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marina, this is a truly remarkable project, and all you have to do to appreciate its value is spend 5 minutes walking in the absolutely depressing downtown, or urbanistically depressing downtown of Austin, to realize what the value of what you're proposing is all about. It's really a fine, fine piece of work. I'm going to be talking about a subject that's more limited. It's more of a method than a project. I would like to begin with a reminder that despite the fact we've gone through 20 years now of significant new urbanist projects nationwide, it is not terribly clear to a lot of people that urban standards alone are not enough in generating an appropriate physical fabric for cities. We started, of course, with battling sprawl-based standards and zoning as we know it. And it is very clear to the ones of us that are architects, at least, that the virus in the zoning mechanism is the concept of FAR, particularly as it is applied proportionately to various pieces of land without exception. For example, that in the case of any particular zoning designation, landowner might own a quarter of an acre of a particular piece of land that is zoned in a certain way, and the same person might own in another block 10 times that amount, and he has or she has the right to build on these two pieces of land proportionally to the size of the land, as opposed to in any sense related to the expected fabric. And the result, of course, is the architecture of the last 50 years, which is basically entitlement cubes of one sort or another draped in the excessive or non-excessive ways that any individual architect can choose to execute. And, of course, by extension, the kind of of environment that we associate with sprawl. These are places that are awful by design, which is something that I keep reminding my French friends who don't believe me. They're not a result of libertarian policies in the United States, but they're completely willed. And of course, the extraordinary problems of incompatibility between buildings existing and proposed or adjacent in adjacent zones. So the question is, how do we get from that kind of world to a world in which objects begin to relate to each other in a way that they make a public realm and a city fabric possible? And how do we introduce buildings sequentially into the city in a way that the fabric remains relatively stable? I want to use the example of a single project to illustrate to you the value and the importance of form-based codes in their dependence on type. This is a project for San Antonio. Just simply a reminder of the fact that in order to have a form-based code, you have to have a vision, a community-based vision, unlike, of course, zoning, which is neutral and applied relatively randomly. For this particular project, there were a variety of zones from T3 to T6 that you see outlined in this regulating plan. And as part of the charrette, there were significant images produced with the help of the community to illustrate both the development potential and the architectural character and urbanist character of the places that the project deployed itself in. At the end of the charrette, we ended up with a catalog of this kind, which at the top describes the nature of each one of the zones, proceeds with the particular requirements of each zone in terms of urban architectural and frontage requirements, use requirements, and so on, but focuses particularly on the question of a series of types and the way in which they might be repeated in the formation of the fabric of that particular city over time. It is important, I think, to pause for a moment and remember that traditional American urbanism, everywhere, all the time, since the beginning of the Republic, has been developed on the basis of this very simple device of dividing the land into zones of mobility, into zones of development, into rights of ways, into blocks, the blocks into lots, the lots into buildings. And it is this transition from place to place and from scale to scale that has given American cities their character. The fact is that in the most recent period of time, the age of sprawl, we've forgotten how to relate buildings to lots and lots to blocks. And I think it is that loss that has generated the kind of lumpiness that we experience incessantly around us. It is also important to think and to imagine that when you actually begin to come to the point of suggesting that entitlement is going to be had not by FAR, but by building type, that various types are allowed within each zone. As you can see here, for this project in San Antonio, there are about 8 zones, and for each zone, certain types are allowed and others are not. You might ask the question, why would anybody ever use a less dense type than the densest allowed in the zone? I think that has to do with a lot of issues that are particular to cities, in particular to moments in development. For example, very recently in Southern California, we're seeing a lot of people wishing to develop in a problematic economy without building parking garages. So people are building less by choice in order to be able to build at all. This is the choice of buildings within a T5 zone for this project. And what we do typically in these kinds of projects, we provide a sheet that describes lot widths, access standards, parking standards, open space standards, landscape standards, frontage standards, building size and massing standards, and accessory dwelling standards for each one of these types. So this is the sheet for row houses, and this is the sheet for live work units. These are important points of public discussion and in public focus in code making, because not only do these documents establish the nature of the fabric to be designed and to be built, but they also describe the terms of the discussion. These are sheets to be read by commissioners and by councils, as well as by developers and by architects. And I want to pause and show you a couple of examples of, and illustrate particularly the nature of, almost in a didactic way, of the way in which these simple requirements begin to define the nature of buildings. This is courtyard housing, which is an area that we've spent an awful lot of time in our practice working on the last 20 years, because we believe is the missing link, essentially, between single-family houses and stacked dwellings. It's this density from about 20 to 60 or so dwellings per acre that most great American cities were formed under in the era preceding 1940. So you see in this simple spread a diagram on the left that shows the basic footprints of buildings reflecting open space requirements, a massing drawing that shows basic the basic concept of repetition of singular dwellings, some sectional requirements, use requirements, and some overall images. But what I really want to do is I want to walk you through, very simply, the consequences of thinking in this particular way and the kinds of objects that arise out of it. There is clearly a requirement for every type, this one included, that they deploy themselves within a kind of envelope, and that the kind of entitlement that they entail is really space defined and lot defined, therefore block defined. So the plan for a courtyard housing project of this type does not exist within a 60 foot wide lot, and certainly loses its meaning beyond a 300 foot lot, but it is best described within the parameters I showed before lot wise. Access standards are very important because courtyard housing is a direct access kind of type. There are no elevators, no corridors, and no lobbies. Sometimes there are elevators to the garage as codes are written for particular places. But it's terribly important to appreciate that there is a direct access requirement to all dwellings for this kind of type. So when you see a project of this kind fronting the street, you can appreciate the fact that there is a main entrance to the building, but this place is an access to a dwelling, this opening is an access to two dwellings, and this opening is an access to a third dwelling. So in the front, the building is porous and accessible to the street, and of course inside, every dwelling is entered either directly on the courtyard or up a stair and into the dwelling. So everything up to a density of about 50 to 60 DUs, maybe on the hybrid side, and maybe 45 to 50 DUs, on the non-hybrid side, can be accessed in this way. The parking standards are important because, of course, the more parking, the more difficult it is to accommodate a building of this kind. In an urban setting, typically we provide about a car per dwelling, up to about maybe a car and a quarter. And the requirements for this kind of parking are very complex. First of all, they need to stay off the main face of the building. Sometimes they can make internal parking arrangements that if properly civilized can become wonderful places. And under the proper circumstances, they can also on a limited car basis, up to five, I think we said in this code, can be accommodated on surface lots in the front of the building. So there are very dramatic and radical ideas like parking in the front, which can be a terrible thing if it's handled badly, but with very careful rules of this kind can produce great buildings. There are open space standards that are very important that define the amount of open space and the actual width of courts when they're north, south, and east, west, of courtyards based on sectional requirements for light and air. And these are the kinds of places that one gets by this kind of calculus. The building to the left is three stories. The building to the left is two stories, and you can see the direction of the sun and the way it strikes the courtyard. And then there are landscape requirements as well. Most importantly, I think, requirements that attempt to turn these courtyards into real gardens, into places that either are on the ground or on top parking, but in both cases stressing the strength of the idea of the garden as a direct extension of the house. Building size and massing standards are important. Each dwelling has to have a certain requirement for light and air. There are enormously important advantages to building in configurations that are not double-loaded corridors, because double-loaded corridor buildings need to be vented and need to be lit artificially in a way that makes them inherently unsustainable. These buildings have passive cooling and passive lighting that makes them very much green from the beginning. As you can see, there are requirements that talk about various aspects of the sculpting of this building. The most important requirement, though, is the one that shows the degree to which the height of these buildings can be negotiated based on the degree to which various floors are covered. And we found that as you advance the density in these buildings, it is possible to proceed by half a story level to more and more and more density, while the building can remain sculpted at the discretion of the architect. And it is particularly extraordinary to see the degree of this kind of code when you see Seven Fountains in the context of the existing fabric of West Hollywood. This building is one third denser than this building, but this building is entirely caught in a double loaded pattern, while this building is actually completely related in its organization to a series of gardens. So the density of this building is approximately 60 dus per acre. The density of this building is approximately 35 dus per acre. So the next allowable type is a hybrid court, and it is particularly interesting to look at the hybrid court as a type, not only because there are much more complex ways of using it within a transect, particularly as street sections and ground floor uses change, but also because the density can increase dramatically in taking at least one side of a building like this, and through the addition of elevators, allowing it to become taller, up to four and perhaps five and six stories sometimes. So what I want to show you here is a similar project to the one I just showed you, but one and a half times as dense, approaching the mid-50s dus per acre. Again, there's a limitation to the size of the lot in which a building like this can be deployed. The reason is that the fabric of the building on all sides, as it relates to the rest of the block, needs to be determined in advance. We need to know whether in a given block you're building one, two, three, or five buildings. And this kind of limitation of measure allows that kind of process to happen. On the axis side, the issues are very similar to what I showed you before. In this particular case, there are, because of the higher density, there are direct entrances on the street, and again, there are secondary entrances here and here within the courtyards. Every single one of 41 dwellings is directly accessible without an elevator, stair, or lobby. The parking standards are equal to the project I showed you before. Typically, again, the parking is put out of the way and becomes relatively discreet. The open space standards are more demanding as the density increases, and you can see that there are three and four-story pieces. It's possible with 40-foot wide courts to have appropriate light and air, as long as these four-story pieces are oriented to the south, and the other side of the court is kept to a lower height. The landscape standards here are equally demanding, and the most important thing is as the type becomes denser, it is essential that at least in one court, one tree goes through the parking all the way to the natural ground and grows full size. So you're not left in this kind of situation where you're dealing with 3- and 4-story buildings surrounding this courts that have pots in them for planting. You can live in a place that is truly in nature if you can accomplish this kind of trick, which is quite extraordinary in the case of a building that is that dense. And the massing standards here are by far more commanding because for accessibility reasons and for reasons that have to do with ADA, these projects need to be fully accessible, and the kind of massing complexity is increased by design, by the way in which on a first level, a second level, a third level, a fourth level, and the fifth level, the appropriate entitlement of building is deployed. Again, keep in mind that this project in this code is without an FAR entitlement. This is the entitlement itself. And then there is a fourth piece, which is the lined garage, and a fifth piece, which is a commercial block. Part of this code is the need to subdivide the land, if the land happens to be more than 2 acres, to subdivide it into streets and into alleys, to introduce lots, and then to introduce types within the slots. So this particular part of the municipal code becomes a commanding device, the key actually to introducing the materials that you saw, and I think introducing the materials that Marina showed you in the case of the Miami 21 scheme. What we're trying to avoid is projects of this kind, projects that are as large as the lots they sit on. Part of the curse of architecture in our time and of urbanism in our time, and please look carefully at Austin around you as you're walking the next couple of days, is that buildings look as big as the lots they sit on. And architecture, therefore, stems out of this cancerous condition and generates places that are completely distorted in their relationship to each other. So we're trying to get away from buildings like this and come to building definitions like this, which allows the same amount of entitlement, but a more orderly and a more complete building form. And this is a building form that you can read, and you can demand to read both in the way in which buildings are deployed in plan, and most certainly in the compatibility of buildings as they're built to the city, and they're completing the form of the city in the solid and in the void incrementally, one building at a time. Thank you.
It's always a tough act to follow with Stefano, so going here. So my name is Dan Parolik. I'm the principal of OptiCoast Design. I like to start this presentation about building types and form-based coding with an image like this. With my architecture background and practice in urban design, the first thing that I always look for when I'm walking around a city or a new place is I really look at the building types, because I feel that the building types and the historic building types that have created these places really become invaluable in terms of learning from them and them providing a building block for what ultimately needs to happen in terms of integration and regeneration of these cities. And one thing that I've noticed a lot in sort of being in some of these mid-tier cities such as Phoenix, San Diego, which this is a picture of, and now being in Austin, is that somewhere along the line, we seem to have forgotten how to plan for design and regulate for the what I'd call the middle, this sort of little fourplex building that you see on the lower right-hand side of this picture. It seems like all of these cities that I'm going to, they're jumping to the big tower, which are appropriate in some places, but there's a what I call the middle, sort of the T4 and the bottom of the T5 that we seem to have forgotten about. And in reading a lot of the current literature, recent literature on sustainability and greenhouse gas emissions, and one of my recent favorites is the Growing Cooler publication, and it talks specifically about compact development and new urbanism as a necessity to for us to implement in terms of us ultimately meeting our greenhouse gas emission reductions. But it goes further into that in talking about blended density as a means by which we need to be thinking about integrating new urbanism and compact development. And to me, this blended density is, in addition to the T6, which we seem to be integrating fairly rapidly in our cities, is this sort of middle zone. The T5 is talking about fourplexes, sixplexes, mansion apartments, courtyard apartments, and really feel that's an important piece that we're missing, that we really need to figure out how to regulate and plan for. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. The basis of my presentation is going to be the last 2 years of my research for the book that I just completed, Form-Based Codes, as well as our work and our practice in both architecture and form-based code writing. It was very much a privilege to be able to take the time or try to find the time to study the most advanced form-based codes across the country, and especially in terms of the building types, understanding the various ways that building types were being integrated into form-based codes. And so I want to take the presentation to actually show the three different ways that we've seen building types integrated successfully into form-based codes. And I'm hoping that we actually get into a conversation as a panel and as an audience to talk a bit more about this. I wanted to start with just really quickly going through a generic list of appellate of building types that's very much based on the work of Mullen Polyzoides, and who's really at the forefront of the integration of building types and form-based codes. But in looking at this appellate of building types, it really, in most scenarios that we've actually looked at applying it, it gets you to about 75% of what might be applicable to a community or a project area. Then you need to calibrate that pellet to the local conditions, local building types, the local climate, in terms of sort of really making that a complete list of building types. I'm just going to do this quickly, starting at the T2 and T3, the detached single unit, single unit side yard, bungalow courts, mansion apartments, townhouse, and jumping to duplex, triplex, and fourplex. Courtyard apartments, stacked units, which can go anywhere from T4 or T5 up to a mid-rise and high-rise condition, live-work units, and then commercial blocks. And the one that's missing is the ancillary unit, but that's a pretty straightforward one. But I really feel if you get on the internet and find some of Mullen Polyzoides' form-based codes and download them and actually study them, it's really a great exercise to understand how their matrix of building types transitions based on the existing context of their projects. So the main portion of my presentation is talking about the three primary ways that we've seen building types integrated into form-based coding. And those three types are, first of all, a building type treated as a land use in a land use table. The second is an entirely supplementary set of building type standards being created, which is the system that Mullen Polyzoides has used most in their coding practice. And then the third way to integrate building types has been actually using the building type as an organizing principle. And I'll talk more about that. The concept of an organizing principle is really what is the framework of your form-based code, and it's a concept we talk about in our book, because as we did the research, it became evident that there were very much prototypical frameworks for the form-based code components. So the first one that I wanted to talk about is building type as land use. And Marina showed a lot of very dense slides, and the two projects that I wanted to show briefly are just extracts from the land use tables of the Grass Valley Development Code update and form-based code that we did for a community in the Sierra foothills in Grass Valley, California. And Miami 21 actually takes this approach as well. And just looking at the Miami 21 land use table, and you can begin to see, especially in the T3 and the T4 zones, once you get beyond that, it gets a bit beyond the building type, but you can see how they begin to integrate the building types into the land use table, and their application to the different transect zones is introduced in the land use table. This is an extract from our Grass Valley Development Code update and form-based code. You can see once again on the residential portion of the land use table, we're actually integrating the building types as a land use. And the challenge here is that it's actually fairly typical way that we see, especially a use like a live-work being treated in a conventional zoning code, where they'll have the live-work allowed in the land use table, and then later on the document, you actually have to define what exactly that use is. So you can use the land use table and the definition of the land use as a way to actually further define those building types. You could actually use standards very similar to what Stefanos had shown you, sort of as that definition of the building type as a land use. And so where we've seen this most applied is where it's form-based codes being integrated into a citywide zoning code. The Grass Valley process was a citywide development code update where they basically threw out their existing zoning code, and a portion of the zoning code was treated in a fairly conventional manner, but done in a way that makes it a much more usable and graphic friendly. But we picked specific areas within the historic downtown and historic neighborhoods and corridors that need revitalization to actually apply pure form-based zones. So that's a good approach to a hybrid. The second type and second approach in terms of implementing building types into form-based code is this the Mullen-Palazzoides practice, which is what I've called supplementary building type standards. And I won't have to dwell on this much because Stefanos gave a really good walkthrough of one of those, several examples from one of their codes. But I think it's important in this example to understand where the building type standards sit in context to the rest of the code. Mullen-Palazzoides actually integrates, which I think is in a very appropriate thing, the building type standards into the architectural standards. So it's really the type that's the primary architectural standard that's driving the architectural standards, but you begin to see that within the form-based code, there are still completely separate urban standards, or what we call building form standards, that give you the building placement, building height, general use type, and parking placement and parking use type. So the building type in this instance is actually integrated into the building form standards, but is actually supplementary regulation and standards to the building form standards. And it's this is an extract from the Mullen-Palazzoides Santa Ana Downtown Renaissance Plan. And this is, similar to the graph that Stefanos had showed you, but I think one of the things that was really eye-opening to me as I talked with Stefanos and several of the folks who work in his office and study these codes is that the notion of the lot size as the primary sort of starting point for the appropriate selection of building type, really a light bulb kind of went off in my mind in thinking of terms of what makes complete sense, because what does it mean to apply, 30 units per acre to a 40-foot wide lot versus 40 units per acre to a 120-foot wide lot? And I mean, the differences that you would get in those two applications are pretty extreme. So the lot width really drives the selection and appropriate application of building type. And this is their their linear continuum of building types, and you can see in this particular instance actually went up to high-rise mixed-use buildings. Once again, this is just an extract from, this is the hybrid court type that Stefano showed you earlier, and he went through the content of these, so I don't need to do that for you. But he went through the massing standards. I think that's the other thing that, in terms of looking at their codes in particular, of the way that the massing is actually regulated, is in my mind really the cutting edge of the way that we need to be thinking about regulating these middle transect zones in terms of building types. And just wanted to show an extract that this is just reinforcing the notion that in addition to the building the building type standards, they still have what we call the building form standards or the urban standards, where they are regulating all of the general urban characteristics, and that becomes the building form standards in this instance. A modified transect become the organizing principle, and the architectural building type standards become supplementary and supportive. And I just like to show a regulating plan to show that the regulating plan still ties directly to the building form standards, and the architectural standards are then allocated by these particular zones in terms of which building types are applicable to each one of those specific zones on the regulating plan. And then the third type, the place where we've seen the building type as a supplementary standards, we've seen it most applied, and Stefanos can correct me if they're maybe working on something more recent, but we've seen it more at a project-specific scale, whether it be a downtown plan, a corridor plan, some more of a defined project area. And there's no reason that it couldn't be applied to a larger scale, but at this current time, that's where it's primarily has been applied. The third way to integrate building types into form-based coding is what we call using the building type as an organizing principle. It basically means that, and the code that I'm going to use for this is actually a code that Kevin's office did, and I guess from what I understand, I think it won a state APA award this past year, but it's actually a master plan and form-based code for a small town called Blue Springs, Missouri. And I think this is great in a number of ways, because what it shows is if you can do form-based coding in this small Midwestern town, I think we can think about the real reality that this is applicable to any community across the country. But what in this instance, what we're doing is the building type, and this is the matrix of the building, the palette of the building types that they use for this code. The building types are actually what the regulations are actually written specifically. The building form standards are actually written in the framework of the building type. So you can see here, this is an extract from the code, and this is what we would call the building form standards. And it's by type, and within each one of those types, they begin to regulate the building placement, setbacks, build tos, parking locations, parking requirements. So it's really the building type is the organizing principle by which the regulations are written. So we've seen this application used mostly on project areas that are smaller in size, maybe a neighborhood or two, a smaller downtown district. We use this application for the community of Isla Vista in Santa Barbara County, which was basically a half mile in length and height in terms of number of blocks. And we're not seeing it used a lot in terms of the building type as an organizing principle, but it's definitely a way, I think Kevin can talk about this more, but it's a way to reintroduce the language of building types into some of these small communities where the builders, the architects, and even the local planners, really the concept of building type is a very foreign concept to them. So it's really reintroducing and using it as an educational tool for the building, for integrating building types into the regulatory framework. A couple of final thoughts. Obviously, this general matrix of building types is not going to apply to all conditions. These are just a couple of of work live courtyard building types that we actually created for a specific plan for an arsenal master plan in Benicia, California, where it's obviously dealing with a much different context and a range of uses. And so that matrix is not always going to be completely applicable, but you just need to be thinking creatively about adapting those concepts and the notion of the building type as a building block into the building type standards. And we've also created building types such as a multi-generational house type that we've coded into several of our projects and working with David Sargent in the central areas of California. And the one thing that I was hoping to include in the book, but just based on the chaos it caused in trying to actually get it together in the end, is I think one of the concepts of trying to tie building types more specifically to the transect and into community types is we started to try to flesh out what is the appropriate application of building types by transect in terms of in some places a T3/T4 might be all row houses, but in most historic neighborhoods in California, for instance, like downtown Santa Barbara, there's really good single-family residential fabric that has well-integrated bungalow courts, well-integrated courtyard types. So we started thinking about in the generalization of the percentage of building types that would be applicable to generalized transect zones. And we actually think that's an evolution and something we can work on with the smart code folks and other form-based code practitioners. So in closing, I just want to sort of set a challenge out to us as new urbanists, architects, planners, and urban designers is really thinking about how we can reintroduce this middle into our planning and our design work, because I really feel that this middle ground is really critical in terms of us regenerating and creating new communities to help us reach our goals in terms of creating compact development that will enable us to achieve our carbon reduction emission goals. And just in closing, there's some really great resources available for form-based coding these days. The Form-Based Code Institute has a website that's starting to build information as a resource. They also teach 101, 201, and 301 level courses. And hopefully you'll get a chance to pick up our book. It's out in the bookstore, and take a look at it and be informed by it. I do have flyers up here that give a brief summary of the book if you're interested in that afterwards. Thank you.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes left before everybody can run off to lunch. So I have time for a couple questions. I have one first for the panel, and then we'll start from the audience. Really quickly, to all three of you, obviously building type standards as part of codes tend to regulate just the basic elements of building design and generally stay pretty hands-off in terms of architectural design. And yet a number of communities still, at least certainly in your debate in Miami 21 and certainly in places we've seen where they want to have more discussion about how much architectural design or how much design review could be added or supplemented to the actual form-based standards. I want to talk a little bit about what you've seen in that regard in your approach to how much architectural and especially style and architectural elements gets into or can be layered onto some of the codes you're working in or that you've seen.
What? How do we turn this on?
Is it on?
It's on.
Sorry. I spoke about this very briefly yesterday, but in this, I think it depends. In the case of Miami, which is a huge city, the planning department, they have a urban design review board, but they don't have the time to review every single project for these for some of these architectural requirements. They don't have the staff for it. There's too many projects coming in the pipeline. So they have the urban design review board that is mandated to review urban design issues above and beyond what's in the code, but they review projects of a certain size and over, those that are that have a major impact on the city. So, and it's about 25% of the large T6 projects. You know, it typically tends to be high density. identity. We've tried to incorporate a few architectural standards in Miami 21, but they're far and few in between. And it's and the example I used yesterday, which I think is still relevant, is the idea of, you know, how do you shield a parking garage, as an example. There's many different ways to do it beautifully and aesthetically, but how to actually to list all the different ways that could be done would just be too impossible. Mm-hmm. So it's a short answer to say it varies.
Well, American architects are at war with the American city because they believe that every building needs to be unique. And I think what we discussed today is that there is a DNA in the American city, and it is through repetition that fabric is accomplished. So that by establishing a code that is based on building types, what you get is at least the essential fabric continuity necessary to begin the process of city making. Now, individual projects do not resolve that subject entirely. I mean, in fine hands, a piece of courtyard housing or a tower or any other building type can be rendered perfectly reasonably as an urban supportive project, but in the wrong hands, it can be disastrous. Yeah. So cities ask us often to provide various levels of augmented material at the style level, sometimes just mere definitions of style, sometimes definitions of proportions and scale of buildings and compatibility standards with existing buildings, and sometimes materials that go all the way down to very serious discussion about the elements of architectural design within each style. We are generally very apprehensive about fixing styles so tightly that they cannot evolve. This is one of the most interesting aspects, the most philosophically challenging aspects of traditional architecture. It is alive, it turns out, or it ought to be anyway. So if you fix it and stiffen it, it ends up dying of its own weight. So it needs to be both defined and open. And that is a subject, I think, that Steve Mouzon and others are doing an enormous amount of work on. And one, I think, we need to concentrate on beyond the question of establishing form-based codes with types as their fabric generator.
Okay. Time for a couple questions. Yes, sir.
You showed some blocks where we're jumping from T3 to T6. Is there a zone change on those blocks, or how did you accommodate that?
Let me repeat the question real quick for those in the back. The question is, in Miami 21, is there a zone change where you have the transition from T3 to T6, or how did you accomplish that?
Well, we did that there are both cases. There are some times where there's a need to densify a neighborhood in which between a T6 and a T3 lot, there was the ability to rezone a few as T4 or T5 in order to transition more smoothly. But in the vast majority of the cases, just by the virtue of how Miami is laid out, you have commercial corridors and single-family neighborhoods abutting it immediately. So we very clearly identified how to transition from additional setbacks in the rear and the side to transition from a three-story to a eight and above story building.
Others? Probably have time for one more. These are short sessions, yes.
Other flexibility in the forms within that envelope. So the density FAR as a maximum
actually became very helpful in our experience. I'm just wondering if you have, that raises any red flags.
In California, where we have the EIR process, environmental impact process, many municipalities are demanding to understand the performance of a downtown, for instance, as projected based on maximum build-out. And under those circumstances, we have to translate in some way the types we're talking about into equivalent FARs. I think the red flag for me in principle is that in the moment in which you concentrate on entitlement by sugar cubes, architecturally speaking, you end up getting sugar cube buildings as opposed to entitlement by live types with a particular, you know, visible presence in the city or in other cities that you can introduce as elements of the DNA of your downtown. So what you're witnessing here in all of these codes that you heard about is just a change in the terms of the discussion. The discourse is about how to shape the fabric of downtown as opposed to how to enrich yourself to the maximum degree by maximizing your entitlement. And it turns out that the most amazing thing of all is that the well-shaped built environment and well-shaped buildings within that built environment is the most effective way of maximizing one's financial returns, it turns out.
Yeah, I don't know if you were here at the beginning of my presentation, but I touched a little bit on that. In Miami, we resisted that at first. We thought just by the form-based coding in the T6s and just establishing height limits, we would be able to that would be sufficient. And we very quickly realized, and part of it with the architects who were really, really pushing back because they felt that their creativity was going to be severely limited and all of that, and because there's such a history of FAR in the city of Miami, and the developers were so reluctant to let go of it. The attorneys, everybody was fighting it. So we tried to do both. We now have an FLR or FAR in the city, and I think, thinking back on it, I thought it's a good idea because there are form-based standards attached to it, but the idea of varying that the FLR with the heights that they're allowed really, I think, gave the architects reassurance that they could now sculpt the buildings any way they wanted because they do have a certain amount of capacity and they have height limits that vary, and so that's going to make for thin towers, long towers, rectangular towers, etc. Francisco might want to add something to that. Why don't you come up here and do it? He's my co. It did. I mean, he's right. I mean, we really tried fighting hard against that, and it was. It was a losing proposition, unfortunately. Yeah.
And we're still fighting it. You know,
fighting SFAR, you mean?
Yeah. We're still fighting it in Evanston, Illinois, where we're working on a downtown form-based code as well. And we're trying to be as actually prescriptive on the dimensional side as we can. But it's back and forth.
There's an absolute political. There's the whole political process and picture of this that impossible to.
I'd recommend studying the Miami 21 code because they made some really nuanced tweaks in the way that they've applied this. That it took me about four times in reading the code to understand. Ultimately, it's about increasing the predictability of the ultimate built product. So I would just recommend that you study that and sort of the nuances.
It's a combination of the two. I mean, I happen to think there's certain prescriptive form-based standards, but it's also attached to an FLR.
There's a difference between, of course, entitling an existing a new place or a place that is being upzoned dramatically and intervening in a place that already has certain expected entitlements in place. I would suggest there are some ways of thinking about loosening the system by introducing new parameters into it. One of them, I think you can very clearly see in downtown Austin and in Miami, is the question of trying to make buildings not self-sufficient in terms of parking and beginning to offer certain incentives based on not providing parking, for example, or even banning parking outright. Because the reason why Austin looks so completely awful is because I have never seen so much parking, structured or otherwise, in one place in my entire life. And if they took one quarter of that investment and build a simple circulator system in the city, it'd be a completely different city.
Yeah.
So sometimes density is not based on the particulars of each individual project, but on issues that are citywide or system-wide.
I'm afraid I need to wrap it up there. We're a little bit over time, but thanks everybody for coming.
Thank you.
We should be talking about what is going on in San Antonio, because I think we need to continue. We have to take all this work and try to take major American cities one by one and try to identify the San Antonio situation. I understand it's a calamity from your point of view, but I think we're being now asked to revisit it.
Yeah, are you working with David Sanders?
Yeah, right. So I think it's something to think about.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know exactly how. I can tell you I know how. Yeah. But
something that I may have.
Somewhere.
Yep.
Yes.
Oh. Pardon?
Cool, you found it. Great.
Thank you. Yesterday and then always showing that I had like architects precedent.
Yeah.
Try that they could do more and find examples in America.
Oh, there were some areas where they could do less, but
you don't want to show those?
We show those, but it's politically hot. You know, it depends on the audiences, basically. And that's the reality of it.
Yeah.
No. That's why, you know, he was making fun of me, and that's perfect. Oh, my God.